Dr. and Mrs. Future Show.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, welcome back to the show, folks. For the next hour, we're going to be talking to local author Marshall Lefferts about his book, Cosmometry, exploring the hollow fractal nature of the cosmos. The introductory sentence reads, "Throughout nature, we can see patterns, structures, processes, and systems that reflect an underlying order of energy dynamics that literally informs that observable universe across all scales." Literally informs the observable universe across all scales. So the cosmometry is the study of this underlying order, wherein cosmic geometry, unified physics, and the harmonic systems of music are seen as three lenses through which to view one phenomenon, universal dynamics of energy and matter manifesting in physical form and flow. So that's the introduction to hollow fractal nature of the cosmos and Marshall Lefferts. Welcome, Marshall.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Good. Good to be here. And we got some stuff to dive into here.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Essentially, you're describing a way of understanding how the nature of the cosmos itself, right? It's sort of your own personal narrative. Well, we all do. I guess we all have personal narratives of how the universe works.
We have a worldview.
Right. Where were you brought up?
I was raised in Darien, Connecticut.
Darien, Connecticut. Okay, yeah. Near the New York border, so right, you're right influenced by...
I always like to think of Connecticut as a Connecticut.
Connecticut, yes. It is. It is a Connecticut.
So this is very far from cosmic New Age thought.
Yeah,
you know, well,
it's not that far.
My brothers and I were children of the 60s, you know, so...
Yeah, okay.
There were influences... Not in my early years at that time, but certainly in my brother's years. And not so long after that for me where I started to connect.
Okay, that's like from a geometric point of view, which seemed to be a major theme here. We're used to thinking in squares for buildings, not a lot of squares, until Bucky Fuller started to enter into our world.
Now it's all about rectangles, right?
Triangles, right? Instead of a connection of two is a connection of three and four.
Buckminster Fuller was such a major influence on so many people, and especially some of the leaders in very paradigm-shifting understanding of the nature of nature and of the universe and of whole systems and sustainability and all that.
So what would you say that some of the seminal ideas of Bucky were that stuck with you? Like inside-outness was one that affected me.
Oh, yeah.
That there was one unifying force that created both inside and outside.
Yeah, they coexist.
Yeah, so it's another triadic thinking kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think most essentially Buckminster Fuller was what he called a comprehensivist as opposed to a specialist. In our education system, it's all geared towards specialization and get your PhD in this one particular niche of one particular field and one particular subject and specialize.
So being a comprehensive generalist, you saw connections between lots of things.
Exactly. Just to see the integrity of the wholeness. And what Bucky Fuller always said was start with universe and then take out the things that are not relevant to what your inquiry is. But you always start from the whole and then work towards where you're trying to get your solution to whatever your problem is.
And so how did you follow that advice?
Just start doing that, right?
Did
you get drafted?
I got drafted in the school of Bucky, for sure.
Yeah. Did it change your plans? Were you Ivy League school and ended up at Antioch or something?
I was 19 in my first year of college. I actually had what I call a frying pan over the head waking up experience one night.
Clang.
And it was a clang, and it's...
Well, what happened?
Really short story is I was having an identity crisis.
And how old were you?
19, who am I?
17. First 19. Freshman year of college.
Okay.
First time away from home.
Did you just get rejected by a girl or something?
No. Mm-hmm. I was just
finding
completely
your own sea legs.
I have three elder brothers, and I realized I had based all of my sense of my worldview and what I liked based on what they liked. And now I'm out there in the world by myself. I'm like, oh my God, I have no idea who I am.
It's up to you now.
It's up to me. And I was going through this crisis, and I was really angry and raging, and I was blaming all the kids in the school and everything around me, and I was in this really terrible kind of state in a very god-awful study room where it was fluorescent lights and yellow-painted cement block walls.
No, you know,
just like, it's going to push you. Learning prison. It's going to push you into a psychotic state just by being in there. And sure enough, I was like, right on the edge, and this thought, in the height of that, this thought came into my mind that I'm creating the whole thing.
You're making all this up?
I'm making it all up. And that one thought was like, pop, you know, it just popped that whole state like, I was in. And all of a sudden,
welcome to the new universe.
Exactly.
You so passed that, level one.
That, exactly right. It was like, you know, going over the threshold. And at that point, then I knew there was something else going on. And among a few things that happened that were really seminal was coming upon, I decided to read a book when I went home that summer at my parents' house, and I found a book called Intuition by Buckminster Fuller.
Oh, that sounds like a good place to start trying to understand Buckminster Fuller before he gets to all the geometry.
Exactly, it's true. But he really kind of set a tone of understanding about this whole comprehensive nature, it's so important to actually see the wholeness in everything. And so that, to me, became my foundational perspective from that point on. Remember,
you start thinking of the whole whenever you have a problem.
Yeah.
After that.
And needless to say, it was not so easy for me to stay in school after that. So I didn't.
Yeah, I would imagine you'd switch it. So where were you? Which school were you in when you
started? I was at Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon.
And what music were you listening to then?
Oh, man. I would get up every morning because it was rainy there in Portland. And for at least a month and a half, every morning I'd put the headphones and listen to Jimi Hendrix. 1983, A Merman I Will Turn to Be, that whole album side, that was just like one of the most true psychedelic epic pieces of music ever. And I would just listen to that and immerse in it every morning.
Oh boy.
So
you created it all, and there you were listening to Jimi Hendrix. Okay. We're definitely in the age of Aquarius now.
So you start having not just different thoughts about yourself, but about civilization as a whole and thinking holistically.
Well, this is 1978. So there was a much smaller available set of information than there is today at that time.
Yeah, four channels on the TV.
And a TV or a radio or a book or, you know, somebody you talk with, not an internet.
And right. So they used to say that there was 100 great books that every great person had read. And if you read those things, then you would have the education of the world.
An educated person.
Now you're supposed to read that like in a year.
Yeah. Right, exactly. So it was a completely... It wasn't like I popped into a full understanding of the nature of reality and myself, and now I was fully functional. I was still a very dysfunctional young person.
Sure, you just had a few new tools to play with.
I had a few new tools and a wider range of inquiry than I had ever imagined was possible.
Uh-huh.
And so I just went into a life's journey that was very kind of free form and not really predicted by certain agenda of what I knew I was going to do or something.
Mm-hmm. It was a lot of being in the moment. Huh?
Yeah, being in the moment and following the breadcrumbs and, you know.
The cues that would come about which direction to go in next.
Yeah.
Like Nassim Harriman, for example.
Hey, we're going to be right back with our guest, Marshall.
Marshall Everett.
Cosmometry.
That's right, cosmometry. Okay, so we're back talking to Marshall Lefferts, and we're focusing on the cosmometry, exploring the holofractal nature of the cosmos, and how to get there, basically.
Okay.
Barbara, actually, we never left.
That's
we never
true.
Left. So, yeah, there's the answer, right?
How to
it was there all the time.
That we're
it's
still
kind of like,
there.
Kind of like Oz, only it's really here. Okay,
well,
so
let's talk about holofractal. That word opens up so much in terms of what you're paying attention to.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
holograms,
when did you start using
fractals?
That? What are you invoking when you tell people about it?
Well, we were talking about this comprehensive perspective in the sense of there being a wholeness to everything. And so at the beginning of my book, Cosmometry, the first section is called Wholeness. And I describe how there are aspects of wholeness that generally aren't really kind of taught as essential to the nature of our reality, and those are that it's holographic, or what I call hologramic in nature. Holographic being that light field is holographic, and then there's holosonic, meaning the sound is the same, where in the case of holographic, the image of the whole is present at every point. And that
yes,
is actually the nature.
That was magical. I mean, there was an idea where it happened, from my mind, the holograms of the 70s.
Well, and those are artifacts of the true nature of the entire light field. I personally feel in contemporary physics, or physics since the hologram was first created, those holograms, they still are confused that it's a two-dimensional surface that projects a three-dimensional image. And what they haven't realized, although I know that David Bohm, the great physicist David Bohm, he did realize this, and he did say it, that it's actually just a slice out of what's already a fully holographic field of light.
Mm-hmm. No projections going on, focusing your lens.
Yeah, you're focusing your lens, exactly.
A holographic slice.
And so that holographic nature permeates the entire universe.
All the time.
And, and also, we were talking about Nissim Haramein, who's a contemporary physicist, very groundbreaking, who I do some work with as well. And he's shown that that same holographic or information hologramic connection exists throughout of all of matter as well.
Mm. Are you saying everything's connected to everything?
Everything. All the information in the entire universe is present at every point.
Ooh.
Which explains things like remote viewing and clairvoyance. Like, what would be a physics model that could explain those kind of phenomena? And this is how it would be explainable.
Right. And so you're saying that thought moves faster than light, but it's still in the same universe?
Yeah. That's right. It's not constrained by the speed of light. That's true. And then the other aspect of the holofractal is the fractal side of it, which is where with the holographic, you have the image of the whole present at every point. With the fractal, it's the same pattern repeats at every scale. And so it's very simple definitions.
Like Illustrator.
Yeah. And it's so very, very simple
imagery
way of having a conceptual model for this wholeness. And the third component is what I got from Bucky Fuller is synergy and his whole synergetics understanding of the geometry and the integration of that wholeness. And the definition of that is the whole is greater than the sum of the parts when taken separately.
Mm-hmm.
There's a phenomenon of something being greater than just the sum of what you have as parts.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the three components that really are fundamental to understanding this model that I call cosmometry.
Well, in a living system, the parts maybe create a body, but then what's greater than the body is when the whole system comes alive.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you could look at all the parts separately and you wouldn't think that's a body. That's going to function.
That's going to create.
That can ride a bicycle.
That can create that consciousness.
Yeah,
can you believe it?
You know, and literally, you can't. If you look at all the atomic elements separately, and you wouldn't think they would make a human body. Just you wouldn't know that it's a synergetic phenomenon.
Hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the beautiful concepts and the illustrations that you have in this book, because I think that the mastery of your medium here is expressed in the illustrations.
Mm-hmm.
And these illustrations are mind-blowing, I have to say. So let's just go through the chapters, okay? Like wholeness. Now, this geometry, I noticed that you're wearing sort of a half of this geometry in a necklace that you're wearing.
Yeah.
So tell us about this. You're calling it the vector equilibrium?
Yeah, well, the vector equilibrium is what Buckminster Fuller discovered back in 1917, over 100 years ago now. And in 1940, he called it the vector equilibrium. And it's the only geometry where all of the vectors, the lines that create the shape of the geometry, on the outside are equal length with each other and equal to the length to the center of the geometry.
Right.
So all the vectors from the center out to the outer points and then all around it are all the same. It's the only geometry where that's the case.
For you watching the 360 screen version right now, you can see it.
Yeah.
On the screen.
And it's made very simply if you take 12 equal-sized spheres and pack them all together around one central sphere, mm-hmm. then all the center points are equidistant from each other. Now, this is what Bucky realized is the geometry of the zero point. It's the geometry of the, what do you call it, the zero phase. So everything then that we know in the universe and observe and can measure is fluctuating, waveforms of light and sound. And at the center of all those fluctuations is this zero point geometry.
And right. So if we took a snapshot of the entire universe in 1 second at the tiniest level of all of the packed spheres that are touching each other, this little voxel unit would be the zero point.
Yeah. When it's in that balanced geometry state.
Okay. So one voxel snapshot of the entire universe. Is illustrated by this geometry.
Can be conceptually seen as that.
If everything wasn't moving, if everything was just stuck in stillness forever.
If it had come into its most balanced equilibrium relationship with each other, that's the pattern it would take.
Okay, so in its pure potential.
Yes.
And it's made of spheres.
That's according to...
That are all touching each other.
Well, so waves and particles, isn't it, at that point? It's always changing between the two.
Yeah.
Like a wavicle or something.
and the Semiramis unified physics theory is founded on the same understanding because he studied Buckminster Fuller also.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he started modeling from that equilibrium state. And in recent years, he put it together that at the very, 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 very small scale called the Planck scale, we have these spherical little oscillators of electromagnetic energy, little toruses that are spinning, but they're not just touching, they're overlapping. Mm. In order to become space-filling.
They're all moving really
instead
right.
of having gaps between, like spheres have gaps between.
Oh, right.
And it's like the flower of life pattern.
Mm-hmm.
They all intersect, and when they're in the equilibrium state, they come into this three-dimensional flower of life arrangement.
Oh, they're all sharing space.
They're all interconnected. Mm-hmm. Hmm. And it's when that medium of space, that geometry of space, goes into larger fractal dynamic rotational movements that you get things we call protons that then aggregate into what we call atoms and
or complex
molecules
dances,
and all the way up into galaxies, and explains, for example, like a galaxy requires this portion of what they call dark matter in order to work the way it does that can't be seen, can't be detected, still don't know what it is. And what Nassim is saying is that it's this, what we can call the Planck field, this underlying field, co-rotating with all the observable matter that creates what we can observe to be there as a additional mass, but it's not expressed as mass, but it's the space, basically.
Hmm.
That's actually co-rotating with the galaxy.
Right. So it's not stuff. It's just location.
It's
location, location,
it's
location.
It's location, and it's, you could say, stuff that's not observable with our instruments because it's so small at that scale.
Hmm. Yeah.
That it's
sounds that is some similarity to, in Star Trek science, the breakthrough equation that allowed them to beam a person from one starship to another while both starships were at warp speed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, there was an equation.
Some breakthrough equation.
Where I believe the key had to do with space itself being a variable, you know, in the equation. So.
Well, see, I got an insight from when you just pointed out the interpenetration of the spheres being like the seed of life.
Yeah.
And your explanation of the phi frequency, how when you were creating the golden mean in Illustrator and you clicked on just one golden mean after rotating it into a beautiful spiral pattern, that you saw all of these points that were, in my mind, there's an intersection.
Mm-hmm.
And at that intersection, you could almost think of that as being the matter that we're studying because those are the interference nodes.
Yeah.
And then everything between them is this interpenetrating energy that can't be measured.
Yeah, that's a good way of saying it right there.
No. And, I read your book.
Yeah.
and I think it's brilliant and beautiful and very clear.
Good.
Otherwise, I couldn't have told you what... You made me think about it.
Yeah, that's great. And then you're able to reflect it back to the author himself.
Yeah.
But that's right. And what you're referring to is what I call the phi boundary condition, which defines form based on the role that the phi ratio plays in the Fibonacci sequence that is related to it. It plays a role. All these mathematical constants play a role in the universe. They're not just interesting mathematical constants. Okay,
well, what role does Fibonacci sequence play? We hear about it all the time. For the uninitiated, tell us about the Fibonacci
sequence. And realize that we might have to go into the break while you're telling, unless you can fit it into the next minute.
So I can't. I learned this from Richard Marek, who wrote a book called Harmonic Interference Theory.
Yeah.
It really was a great revelation for me when he stated that the role that phi and Fibonacci plays is in large part to take frequencies of electromagnetism or sound that are not in whole number ratio relationships like in the harmonic series of music. It's all whole number, and the whole universe is quantized in whole number ratio relationships. And it takes those ones that are not and grabs them and damps them back down to zero. So it's actually damping down, creating the conditions to allow for resonance to occur. In order to have resonance, you need to have boundaries and coherence. And in between the resonance, you need stillness and silence.
Wow, I didn't get that. So there's sound cancellation happening outside of the harmonious intersections.
In order to have even form, even anything that has a resonant boundary condition, needs to be contained by something that is not that. It needs to be brought back down to zero. And the Fibonacci is what's creating that. It actually, basically, he calls them phi damping wells, that it basically grabs the enharmonic frequencies, as they're called, and steps them back down to zero.
And it's used in many different domains of universe.
All right. Consider that while we go to this break.
Yeah.
Thank you, Marshall Lefferts, Cosmometry.
Back to the show. You were saying something. Why should you care about all this, Mrs. Future?
Yes.
Vector equilibrium.
One of the effects of this book, Cosmometry, had on me.
Yeah.
Of course, I have appreciated the aesthetics of the Seed of Life for a long time, but I was on the outside looking in saying, well, okay, I understand that people are really interested in this geometry, this symmetry, this aesthetic, but beyond that, it's a beautiful, soothing design. Why do we care so much about it?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I really feel that your book addresses that beautifully.
That's great. I'm glad. Yeah. I had that same feeling for decades.
Yeah?
Just like, well, Flower of Life, okay, that's cool, but what is it? Why does it matter? And now, understanding the relationship to the structure of space, to the vector equilibrium, to the physics, provides a foundation for its function and role. Again, all these things have a function and a role. So what is that?
Flower of Life. For those who haven't seen it, how would you describe it?
It's an array of interpenetrating circles that are in a hexagonal or triangulated relationship with each other. And it's basically the same equilibrium geometry as the vector equilibrium, just a two-dimensional representation of that same kind of a geometry.
Yeah, and I think it's very familiar. People see it on books. People see it. A lot of things that are considered mystical or spiritual or New Age will have the Flower of Life.
We saw that in Egypt, I believe.
Yeah. Did you go to Abydos?
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw it there too. Yeah. It's really cool.
Yeah, the Church of Abydos.
Yeah.
The Flower of Life.
Yeah.
So we know it's ancient and that the insights that people were having are relevant today.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why you were mentioning this necklace I have on, which is one of Nassim's arc crystals. I don't know if you're familiar with the arc crystal. But you can put it up on later on your
show. Yeah, I saw it briefly. It looked pretty interesting. But what's the secret of the arc in this case?
So it's a tetrahedral-shaped quartz crystal that's grown in the laboratory to be extremely precise in its molecular symmetry.
So an extremely precise crystal grown by humans.
And the same tetrahedral geometry of the molecular structure is the same as the structure of space that we were just talking about. It's a triangulated, or it's a tetrahedral array, basically. Mm-hmm. And so it actually is coherently resonant with this underlying structure of space. Now, the thing with space that is finally getting more and more admitted in physics is that it's not empty. Space is not a vacuum that's empty. It's actually extremely full of energy. We know that the universe we observe is only 4% of what it takes to have the universe. There's another 96% that's called
dark matter.
Where did it go?
It's giving space a new lease on life here. It's not just a vacuum anymore.
Exactly. So that 4%
is not just taking up space.
It's emerging from this background energy.
Huh.
And this kind of geometry, this tetrahedral geometry, is in symmetry with that same structure. And so this crystal that's in this arc crystal pendant connects into that field and creates a coherent flow, because it's actually not just energy, it's information.
Mm, the way information flows.
Exactly. And so our whole body systems are information processing all the time.
So by you reflecting on this, as you see it around your neck, you tune into those frequencies, if you will.
Yeah,
as kind of a tuner into the universe.
And they also literally, they've done quite a bit of testing with water, and it structures water. So water molecules are also in that same geometric relationship when they're in a coherent state.
Hmm.
A lot of the water we get out of taps is no longer in that coherent state. So you can take this crystal and put your water on it overnight, and it will restructure your water. And when you wear it, it structures the water in your body.
So it sort of acts like a magnet, causing certain things to face certain directions? Or when you say it structures it, what do you mean?
It's similar to what you're saying, although it's not a magnetic effect, but it's similar in the sense that it's reorganizing how the atoms are coming together to cohere into the water molecules and bringing them into not only greater single atomic or single molecule coherence, but multiple molecules coming together to create more coherent structure throughout the whole of the water.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there were alchemical glasses where the stones were on the inside of the glass, and so the water, when poured into the glass, would structure the gems would structure the water.
Yeah, exactly. So when we drink structured water or we wear the pendant like this, the water in our body can process information more coherently.
Just less static.
Yeah, less static, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So,
and that helps with our own biological well-being as well as our own consciousness being, because it's all one and the same thing.
Here, have a drink before you say anything.
Drink some water.
Yeah. How big is the field that's created from that crystal?
I don't know precisely, but it's, I think, a few feet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they've actually measured photon emission coming off of the point of the crystal, which means it's literally generating energy. It's like a free energy device.
Okay, so from something
accessing
to
the field.
From nothing to something?
Exactly.
Do you feel it?
No, don't really necessarily feel. I mean, well, I shouldn't say that. Yes, you can definitely feel it.
Mm-hmm.
I can give you this crystal. And you can put it on your palm and put your hand over it like this.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have magnetic, little tiny magnets inside them, and you can cluster a few of these crystals together.
Hmm.
And if you put eight together, boy, you could really feel it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of, they say, dosage.
How would you characterize what you're feeling when you hold your hand over it?
Well, are you tied in?
You said photonic.
You tune into the resonant frequencies that it represents. You're just saying, right?
So. Yeah. And you can feel, I mean, our bodies have a biofield, as it's called now, around them.
So we get information through those channels.
Yeah.
Much like a biological internet of some kind.
And our nervous system, our brain, our heart, our solar plexus, our central nervous system are really an antenna system that is interacting with this field.
Right.
Not the generation of consciousness, but the
mediation
system, the system through which we are interacting with this whole
the nature itself,
field.
That's sort of a connection.
Locally and non-locally.
Oh. And so in meditation, then people are really just trying to pay attention to what their bodies are tuned to.
Yeah, and clearing out a lot of the distractions so that the direct source to the greater field can be accessed.
Yeah.
Because we get distracted by everything that's around us.
We're very species-centric in terms of our attention. But to tune into the bigger universe, we're hardwired for that, is what you're saying.
We are.
Actually, yeah.
We are. It's our true nature. And we have our local experience of consciousness, of our being, of our sense of identity.
Yeah.
And that's not the limit of who we are.
We have the cloud. We have the rest of humanity.
We have the rest of the universe.
There's the universe,
I'd say,
right?
I think our senses are like these very flexible filters that allow us to be very adaptable to all kinds of
different frequencies at particular times. Filtration and frequency choice.
We actually have to filter out the totality in order to have
a choice.
A local relative experience.
Yeah.
If we were to become aware of the totality, we would just dissolve.
We'd burn out, right?
Completely lose our energy. We would lose our identity completely.
It's like, oh.
Like,
we'd
no longer be
we'd
separate.
We'd just be one with all that
with
is.
With all that is.
440 on 110 device.
In fact, we already are. Yeah. We already are self-annihilated on a level beyond this little crystal of temporary sanity.
Well, some say that's why you only allow cosmic knowledge in at a certain speed that your system can handle. Otherwise, you could fry your circuits.
The speed of time.
Yeah,
that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. If your nervous system is not ready to handle that much information, it will overload.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Trip and overload circuit of some sort.
You have to reset, go back. Kundalini awakening can fry some people out because it's just too much too fast.
So knowing how to choose what's next for your own soul's journey is a personal choice. But there are a lot of options out there for doing it.
That's true.
Including paying attention to the way the universe actually works, or seems to work.
Yeah, and the beautiful thing is we're really beginning to understand that from not only the spiritual perspective, but from the scientific perspective and the physics and the biology. And the model, it's very sensible. It's not actually even that difficult to understand. So much of physics in the past 100 years got so abstract and so mathematical. And like, I'm not a physicist. I wouldn't innately be able to understand it, but still, it is just like so out of any logical sense of understanding. Whereas the unified physics model is really quite simple, fundamentally, foundationally.
I understand how biology is alive, but do you think the rest of the universe is an interactive, living thing?
Well, I do.
Yeah.
I do.
But different from us as a species.
You know, our version of what we call consciousness is not the only one out there.
So it's infinite intelligence, essentially.
Yeah.
That's why the mushrooms say, you're talking to me.
Exactly.
So everything's intelligent.
Just talk with a mushroom, you'll find out.
Yeah, as if it's all alive. So you must be an animist. All of it's alive, then we're more communicating with it than learning about it.
And that's why you think of our biology as a fractal antenna system rather than the generator of consciousness, it's interacting with a universal field
like
of consciousness.
Like an intergalactic transceiver of some sort.
The informational component of the physical energy matter reality is what is being exchanged and fractally getting more complex and more evolved across scale. And it ultimately comes into a complex biological system like us that then becomes self-aware. It's a feedback loop. So the whole, within the entire structure is a flow of information and a feedback loop that everything knows about everything else through this feedback loop. And so it's constantly evolving with that awareness.
How does the system deal with something like fake news?
It doesn't. The rest of the universe doesn't. We humans are suffering through this phase.
I see. That's a result of the way we think, huh?
It's
We expand it a little bit. We might get...
I wouldn't even call it a worldview.
Alrighty. Well, to be continued after the break. On the Dr. Fischer Show, Marshall Lefferts. I always would call you Efforts, but
it
I remember this
Efforts to say
effort
that
to say Lefferts. Okay. Michael Lefferts. Welcome back to the show. We're talking to Marshall Lefferts about his book,
Cosmometry. There's a mom in there.
Yes, I remember the cosmometry.
It's the big mom, the big cosmometry.
And reharmonizing energies as being a key thing to do with yourself.
Okay, well, you ready to hear from Daddy Bird and Salinas?
Yes, let's talk to Daddy Bird for a moment.
Hi, Daddy Bird. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Can I ask Marshall, when you said you had your conflict when you first went to college, where were you going to college when that happened?
I was at Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon.
And then did you go to graduate school to learn your cosmetology or whatever?
Cosmometry. No, I stopped going to school after another year of attempting to try to be in that system. I just knew it was not going to serve whatever my path was. So
it's your gap year.
I didn't even graduate from college.
What do you do for work?
I presently working on the sequel to the film Thrive with the filmmakers Foster and Kimberly Gamble.
Thrive 2, right?
So I'm working on Thrive 2 right now. Mm-hmm. I was an associate producer of Thrive 1, so I'm working on Thrive 2, helping to co-direct visual effects, which is taking a lot of these ideas in the book and putting them into a 3D and animation. It's going to be really, really cool. Then I just got my book out, so I'm working on that. And I also work with the Resonance Science Foundation as a faculty of the Resonance Academy.
Yeah. What's the Resonance? What is now? Resonance Science Foundation?
That's Nassim was involved in. Isn't that down in Southern California now?
Yeah, Resonance Science Foundation is the nonprofit organization that he founded in 2006. And I've been on the board of directors since 2008, I believe.
You heard of Nassim Harriman?
Daddy Bird? Are you Googling or what?
Yeah. Nassim Harriman. Nassim's a very interesting thinker in the realm of physics and the nature of the universe. He's been getting a lot of interest these days. It reflects a whole new paradigm of which Marshall is part.
And sir, are you familiar with the Divine Light Mission?
You mean Guru Maharaji? I remember first him, the 14-year-old perfect master. That one?
Yeah. Are you related to that, or do you do the same thing they do? Or
I am not directly familiar or related to that.
Everybody here is guru-free. We are self-gurus.
I stopped the Mercedes-Benz that had the head of it. I guess he was the king of the... I'm wondering now if I'm going to get in trouble because I stopped him when he was at his height, when he was at his highest.
How old was he when you did that?
You mean at his highest speed?
They're going about 80 in a Mercedes sedan, five of them.
You know, he flies his own jets, too.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm still trying to figure out, where can I see a picture of that stone that you have or that design you talk about? The circles. Can that be seen on the computer somewhere?
Well, the pendant is at ARC. Crystals, A-R-K, crystals with an S.com. If you go to my website at cosmometry.com, you can see some of the images there of what we were referring to.
Okay, that would help me to understand a little bit. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right, thanks for calling.
Bye.
Yeah, so something that I wanted to bring up, Marshall, is some of the practical applications of the information that is in this book. And this book is a beautiful bridge from very abstract ideas of harmony and physics and color and frequency and things like that. But then you also have a profound appreciation of music and of the harmony in music, and also of the patterns of nature and how all of these things are connected. So I am very curious about the frequencies that are helpful to humanity versus the frequencies that are harmful to humanity. And I'm sure in your research you've come across some of that.
That's exactly right. And in my book I reference the research of two men from the Netherlands, Dirk Meijer and Hans Giesink, who did a meta-study of over 500 research papers from across 50 years of research to determine what electromagnetic frequencies are beneficial to biology, to cells and biological life, and which ones are detrimental. And they have mapped out what they call an algorithm for life, which has a base reference scale. It's actually a 12-tone scale, which music is a 12-tone scale. And it's not that they were trying to fit it to the musical structure, it's just that it naturally does so. And just by studying all the data and mapping it out, that 12-tone scale, by the way, for all those interested in the 432 hertz versus the 440 hertz question, 432 is part of that scale. And then you can take that reference scale and then map it across, I think that's 156 octaves of frequencies. And so you have a set of frequencies that are beneficial, are harmonious to biological life. And then you have in between those frequencies ones that are detrimental. And this is, I think, one of the most essential aspects of information that is really needed to be brought into the world at this time, because my understanding is either our current technologies are just ignorantly, not really consciously
probably
considered.
Mostly that, since it's been very random how it came into being.
Random, or less desirably, maybe consciously made to be detrimental to put people in stress.
Well, there's a lot of weaponization in the consciousness of humanity.
Yeah, so whether it's either one of those, the point is that we can take this understanding of the beneficial frequencies and apply it into our technologies now and basically create a harmonization with the natural frequencies of the world and the universe.
You think that could be done with cell phones?
Absolutely, I think so. I think any technology that has an electromagnetic frequency radiation.
So it's a matter of choosing the right frequencies that are harmonious with nature.
Yeah, and it's probably just a small adjustment. It's not like have to radically change it, especially when you get to those frequencies, the wavelengths are very small.
And it can be very specific. Like the frequency for microwave ovens is very close to Wi-Fi, and yet they're very different purposes.
Yeah, yeah, and well, power.
And part of the 5G rollout is that they're getting increased capacity by coming up with 100 microchannels of how to transmit the data, and it's point to point at 100 different frequencies. So it must be possible to choose frequencies that are a little variable, that we can choose frequencies that are in the range that are beneficial.
I'm sure it is.
Can you quickly find out what's good and what's not for you? I mean, is that, should the scientific evaluation process be speeded up?
Do you think? You use this reference scale and then transpose it across different frequency ranges.
That'll give you a specific place to test.
Yeah. It's very simple calculation and a reference model.
Yeah, you're looking for whole numbers in frequencies, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like music.
Yeah, and it is music. That's why,
really?
You know,
does
music,
it have a melody or something?
If it sounds good, it probably is good.
Yeah.
Of course, you can't really hear those frequencies, right? They're out of our audio range.
All of those are out, yeah. Yeah.
And yet, they could be scales of what's in our audio range.
Yeah,
exactly. They are in the same ratio relationships in octave.
Mm-hmm. Bring them down a few octaves.
That's why they have a reference scale that is defining what those beneficial frequencies are.
So maybe we need 5G frequencies that are harmonious with Jimi Hendrix or something. Right?
Well, harmonious with our cells in our body.
Well,
is it possible that something real sci-fi could happen? Like
Jimmy was already tapped in. I think he actually tuned his guitar, because he wasn't tuned to A440. Yeah. He was tuned down a little bit lower, probably closer to 432, just because his ear liked it.
Uh-huh.
And so I think it was a natural inclination.
Okay, well.
Jimmy's in there.
Come on, scientists, find out which frequencies are really the ones we want.
It could be that if we tune into this, that turns out these phones were just telepathy training devices, and you throw them away once we're connected.
Ultimately, I think that's true.
It's something where, boom, you turn on this telepathic circuit, and boom.
Telepathic.
And we're connected, and then job's done.
Yeah.
It could be that they're just used temporarily to that. But that would require tuning in to actually how the whole system works and how biology works and what frequencies it's using for evolving, and then utilizing those in our technologies.
And that's why this whole idea of this harmonic theory we were talking about earlier is really foundational to all of biology, physics, chemistry. Mm. It's and I call it my book, The Master Code.
The Master Code.
Because it applies across all the scientific domains, and once you understand how they're all interacting and how to basically, you know, we have the opportunity in our world to reharmonize with this cosmic nature that's already permeating all of nature and all of the universe. All we have to do is shift back into harmony with it, and we'll stabilize all of our systems in this world. And we'll take out all the stressors from our biology.
And you're saying we're really close, which just needs to be a little adjustment on the dial.
So I think we have all the knowledge and all the technology to do it.
Hmm.
I think it's going to happen very quickly.
And you can get to some of that knowledge if you go to cosmometry.com.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to tell us for
true
people
renaissance,
who want
perhaps?
To find out more after the show?
Boy, is this a true renaissance in your opinion?
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think it's either a true renaissance or it's a ultimate demise.
We'll either make it or break it.
The clock is going to go bong, and that'll be it.
This is the counter-reaction to the clock.
Yeah, it's totally, what I'm saying. Let's obsolete the clock, you know.
Tension is good, right?
Okay. So if we want to know more.
Tension is good.
Where can our audience go?
Well, Cosmometry, cosmometry.com is the website where you can learn about my book and other things there.
And email?
ML@cosmometry.com.
ML.
My initials.
Cosmometry. All right.
Reach out.
You want us? Future.
Thank you.
KSCO.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
You're welcome. Thanks for being here.
Appreciate it.
I think we're heading in a really fun direction with these focuses these days.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, folks, and feel free to join in. Send us some email, whatever you have to contribute. We appreciate it. Thank you.
And that's it for another week on the Dr. Future Show here on KSCO Santa Cruz. Thanks for listening.